Fantastic Pixel Castle and Frog Pants Studios presents Word on the Street with Greg Street and Scott Johnson.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Word on the Street. This is our March edition. It is actually Tuesday, March 12th, 2024. I'm Scott Johnson, and Greg Street joining me as he does every month for one of these. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Scott. How are you?
Do you think there'll ever be one of these where you're just like, I'm fishing. Do it without me. Probably not.
Yeah, I love it.
Well, I love having you on, of course. And part of the reason I like doing this is because, well, first of all, we're old friends. But second of all, I'm as excited as everybody else is for this game. And I had somebody during the month say, Scott, are you worried about being seen as kind of biased in this whole discussion? Like, you won't be able to ask the hard questions because you're as interested as the rest of us in playing this game. And I said, probably. I don't know. I have no idea. Maybe I am biased.
Ask the hard questions. That's what we're here for. It's fun.
Yeah, we're going to ask the hard ones. That's you know, whatever. That's part of this. It's great to be back with you. We are going to go very technical today. We're going to look under the hood, which is ironic because my car broke down this morning, and they're looking under the hood right now. I don't think that'll be near as fun as what we're going to do today. So please join with me, if you will, welcoming our guests. First of all, we have two of the great engineers of the Ghost platform, the brand new MMO coming out from Fantastic Pixel Castle. Let's start first with Cam. Cam, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
Good to see you, sir. Also, James. James joining us from overseas. Hello, James.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show today.
Good to have you both here. James and Cam have their finger on all the buttons over there at Fantastic Pixel Castle. They are saddled with the challenge that is make all the creative ideas we have work. And make them work to scale and make them work in perpetuity so that players never get disconnected or ever have to wait in a queue. I'm sure that's all worked out by now. You guys have figured out all those day one problems and we're ready to hit the road. maybe not so much, but we're going to find out exactly what is going on the back end over there. And I'd love to, first of all, kind of hear about your backgrounds. Like, Cam, tell folks where you've worked, what you've done, kind of, you know, a roadmap to how you got here.
Yeah, sure. So I'm the CTO at Fantastic Pixel Castle. I've spent most of my career in the games industry. I worked on League of Legends for a long time. I worked on an MMO called Guild Wars 2. I did work on some other games, L.A. Noire and Need for Speed, and a whole bunch of games you've never heard of. That's okay. I did briefly work at Apple on their headset thing, and then at Meta on their Metaverse thing, and then I'm like, nah, I got to go get back to making video games, and so that's why I'm here working on Project Ghost.
That's fantastic. Almost like the name of the company we're working for. That's awesome. James, where do you hail from and what do we know your work from?
Well, I worked on World of Warcraft for a long time and then on a couple other classic games like Diablo 2 Resurrected and Warcraft 3. Then I moved over to work on Fortnite for the last couple of years and now I'm here at FPC as an engineer.
Wow, that's fantastic. So you guys have seen some stuff. You've been on the front lines of what it takes to make the engineering side of things go. And I'm always really curious about that, not that contrast, because I'm not sure it's really a contrast, but when the creatives want a thing and the back end and the engineers have to make that thing happen, I assume there has to be a lot of compromise and a number of meetings and a sort of like prototype tennis match to make sure you can even come close to what that vision is. So to start off, Greg, as the visionary, you know, guy in charge of the studio, the one that came in with all the big ideas. And now you got a bunch of really great creative people around you helping with that. Is how much do you have to think about that when you're designing this game from the beginning? Like when you say, well, I want this world, I want these characters and I want this vibe or whatever. Do you have to think about what the guys behind the scenes have to make real for you before you make those decisions, or kind of how do you handle that?
The way I like to approach it is to not limit yourself too much at first, because, I mean, technology changes, there's new approaches. It's better to start off and say, these are the goals. This is what we'd like to do. Tell us what's going to be hard and what's going to be easy. And good engineers almost never say no. They'll say, well, this is what you have to keep in mind, or this is the trade-off, or that sort of thing. Right. Rather than try to assume I know all the technical stuff, I think it's easier just to ask and say, hey, if we want to have combat with 500 characters at once, what's that going to be like? Or what, you know, what do we have to keep in mind?
Is that an actual question that's come up, like large-scale battles, that sort of thing?
I mean, this is not going to be a game based on large-scale battles, but part of the player expectation is that you don't run into problems where what we will not do is pop up a big error message that says no more than 10 players allowed in this area at once, you know, that kind of thing. You don't want to interrupt that. So you have to kind of be seamless and support when it's you fighting a goblin going all the way up to like a large scale, you know, world boss or PvP match that just kind of happens out of nowhere.
James, does that square with you in terms of, you know, getting along with creative? And when I worked in sales years and years ago, it was always this battle between us and the tech guys, and us overpromising and them having to figure out how to deliver. Is that a challenge in the past? And I guess, you know, what are you guys doing to address that challenge as a new team?
Yeah, that's an interesting problem. You want to give designers as much power as possible, but then you also don't want to give them too much rope to hang themselves with, right? So I think it's really interesting, the innovation that came out of games in like the 90s and early 2000s, where they didn't have the technology we have now. And now we're kind of in the blue sky phase where the sky's really the limit. So it's about a negotiation between engineering what's capable and designers what they want. So when Greg says he doesn't want to pop up saying, oh, there's too many people in this area, well, there should be some hard limits where we don't want the server to crash if there are 10,000 people in one spot, of course. But we're going to be driven based on design, what the design goals are. Like, so for example, we want large cities where you can have lots and lots of people, but not necessarily lots of combat. So we're going to design the servers to handle lots of players there, but turn off the expensive features of like combat processing. But likewise, in combat areas, maybe you don't need 1,000 people, but you do need to be able to have really interesting moment-to-moment combat. So designing our tech to fit based on what design needs are upfront. And like I said, it's a negotiation. So we'll try to hit the goals, really, that they're setting out for us. But we're working together, and we're already started on that.
Well, to get to current, you guys are using Unreal. You announced it in your initial AMA, Unreal Engine as the backbone of what's going on here. And there was a lot of talk even then during that roundtable about having to do a lot of custom work, having to really tweak things and I don't know, bend it to your will. And a lot of people, when they think of Unreal, they think, oh, shooters and third-person action games and, you know, fancy cutting edge technology with 5 and 5.2 and all this sort of thing. As an MMO engine, you don't hear about it very often. I'm 100% sure it probably exists, but I, to be honest, I hadn't heard of an MMO in active development, until you guys mentioned that you were going to go that direction, I guess. And we'll start with James, then move to Cam. I'm curious what challenges exist in getting Unreal to be your best friend here and to make it work. And we've got some other engine questions coming up, but I'm curious about that part of it. How much wrestling are you having to do with that engine to get it to, you know, bend to your will?
Yeah, that's probably the hardest problem we're facing in terms of using Unreal. Unreal is a fantastic platform for us to use. It solves 95% of our problems. Cam will dig into that in a minute. But the one thing it doesn't do is host kind of an MMO architecture, because Unreal was built for Unreal Tournament and for Fortnite and for games like that, where they're match-based games. So you join a match, you connect to a server, you play for 10, 20, however long, and then you disconnect, right? Whereas an MMO, we want our servers up for weeks, and we want people to be able to move between servers. So like it's a large, seamless world. So that's one of the major technical challenges, is supporting a server architecture where we can connect to more than one Unreal dedicated server at a time and still have all the combat features that Unreal unlocks for us.
Interesting. And Cam, how does the engine, as James says, how does it already solve most of your problems? And I don't know, what are some of the challenges you see with it?
Yeah, a lot of games have a lot of tech in common. Like the things you need to build an action game or to build Fortnite, you need all of those things to build an MMO. An MMO is a little bit like, I don't know if you remember in Jurassic Park, where they're explaining about how hard it is to have a park full of dinosaurs. And they're like, well, we've got all the problems of a theme park and a zoo and Disneyland. And like, that's what an MMO is. It has all the problems that every other game has. And then it has a whole bunch of other problems. And so those are the things we need to solve. So the fact that all of the first problems are solved, all the theme park problems, they're already solved, but we don't have the zoo problem, or we don't have the, the theme park problem solved. Those are the things that, that we need to solve in addition to all the work that the engine already solved for us. And so it's great to have that like initial kickoff that we can just have all of those, the baseline for what you need for a game like Fortnite solved for us. That's amazing. And then it's our problem to then solve the rest of it to build up the MMO backend and to add all the initial features.
Interesting. So the game, the Unreal Engine does say to me and players like, hey, this is for your quick get in, get out. But in recent years, it's also been very clear about, hey, we also have just huge worlds now. And guess what? Right. Fortnite is 100 characters all fighting to be the final person and be the winner. That would have been crazy talk during Unreal 99 or 2K4 era, Unreal Engine 1 or 2 era. And rightly so. It just seems like that thing has evolved to the point that, I don't know, in a weird way, it feels like you guys are one of the few who are saying, well, look how capable it is now at these sprawling vistas and long draw distances and ability to do, frame loading from a distance and not have it look like garbage or have to change frame rates of how far away something is versus how close it is. So when I heard you guys were doing it, I went, oh, well, this is exciting. They're going to be able to harness all of those things that make it such a big, beautiful place to hang around in a world built in the Unreal Engine. But then I started getting down to the nitty gritty going, well, all right, but what about when I'm AFK for 5 minutes because I had to run to the fridge? Or, what is Unreal when no one's doing anything? Or when you're just sitting in town chatting and having social interactions with other players. For whatever reason, that all sounds foreign in that environment. And I assume that's what you mean about some of those problems or having to, get the game into a place where you don't want people to log in and go, oh, I'm in an Unreal game or Unreal Engine right. game. I want to get in and go, I'm in a really immersive MMO full of amazing sights, sounds, and experiences. I just think we underestimate as players what that means or what that takes, despite what the engine may have come with. What is the advantage, though, of going with, say, something like Unreal or Crytek or any other engine that's out there, rather than building something of your own? I don't know who's best to speak about this, but what are the advantages of going with this versus, hey, we want to do something from scratch? Is it only cost? Is it other things?
Well,
You go, James.
Okay. Yeah. So we like Greg likes to say, we want to actually ship this game. So building a game at today's standards of AAA needs to have a tremendous number of features, right? And so we practically can't build something from scratch in that amount of time that comes anywhere close to having the number of features that Unreal already has. So to us, it makes a lot more sense to start with Unreal and fill in that 5% it's missing of the innovations that we're trying to do anyway for Blue Zones and for the MMO server architecture. So you talked about like what it doesn't do well. Unreal's a great product, but it's used to short game sessions. So when you're sitting AFK in the town, all of the NPCs off in the other zone next to you are still walking around and pathing and thinking and everything, right? And so one of the challenges we have to solve is supporting thousands of actors that are just ticking away all the time, because that can be a bit expensive.
So, Cam, anything to add to that?
Yeah, just like, plus one to everything James just said. And also just like what happens on day one. I make this joke a lot, but it is also totally legit. If I said to Greg, hey, good news, you just need to wait 3 years and you'll get a triangle on the screen. Like, that's just a non-starter, right? Like, we need to have something to do on day one. We need to start building a video game, not a bunch of technology. And then 3 years later, you start building a game on top of it. And so Unreal gives us that. Like, on day one, we can already be start building out a lot of our core gameplay, a lot of our gameplay loop. And then at the same time, we have a core tech team that are building out the kind of MMO additions to the engine that we will need in the long term, but are not blockers in getting us to start actually building a video game.
Interesting. So what this reminds me of, or I think about this a lot, in the World of Warcraft early days, they were building upon a modified internal engine that was used to make Warcraft 3. Okay. And if you think about it, it just sounds crazy now, but that's where that started. And then, you know, it's evolved over time. And I'm sure that if you looked at some of the code might look familiar, but most of it has gone through massive changes over the near 20 years that we're looking at with that game. I assume that one of the key components of a live service game, especially in an MMO, is pipeline and tools. Like, how are you enabling devs and creatives to make what they need to make, when they need to make it, and as quickly as they can, or, you know, whatever your timelines are to make those things? Is there a big priority right now to build out those tools now, or do you suspect that more down the road? James, do you want these artists to have, you know, cutting edge zone making tools and character interaction tools and scripting tools from day one? Do they already exist in the Unreal Engine? And so I'm just talking about nothing here, or is that a thing that just takes time and you're going to have to work on it?
Yeah, that's a great point. So that's one of the major motivations for using Unreal, is that it's an industry standard. So artists and designers coming out of college all know how to use Unreal. So if we were to build tools, not only would it take us the time to kind of get started, but then we'd have to train people on it. So we can hire people who have already hit the ground running. Like, we started the prototype and we're already building stuff. We don't need to solve the problem today of having hundreds of players together, because we don't have hundreds of players to test. So they can just jump into the editor and start building things. And so the tools that come in and part of the pipeline of Unreal Editor, it ties into the content creation tools, means that they can get started building both gameplay and tech art right away with, like I said, industry standard tools. So we've already hit the ground running and we're making things which we will likely be able to use later on. But since we're still in prototype, a lot of it will be just thrown away or redone, or maybe not exactly end up in the final state it is now. But Unreal Editor is a great tool for building what we need. We already have most of it, but to answer your question, we do probably need some tools for designers to build levels the way we want to build levels, like for Blue Zone Generations, for example. So we are working on those tools now. But we start with the vast majority of tools we need to just get content into the game with Unreal.
So we've talked about Blue Zones. Blue Zones have come up a number of times. And this seems like a perfect transition to maybe go a little bit deeper. I think people have a basic understanding of what you guys talk about when you talk about blue and red zones and how that's all going to work. But let's go deeper. Tell me how, first of all, let's get a full definition of the system that Blue Zones represents, and from a technical standpoint, what is a Blue Zone to a player?
So one of the things we're really trying to accomplish with Ghost is to address replayability, because doing even really, really interesting MMO content over and over again is where people start to burn out. So, like, I've done this quest. Yes, it was a great quest. I don't want to do it four more times. Or I've seen this, you know, this zone is beautiful. I love it, but I'm tired of it and there's nothing new here, so I don't want to go there anymore. The whole idea behind Blue Zones is they're different every time. The terrain is largely random. The systems you might find are kind of roguelike, to when you set foot in a Blue Zone and you don't know what you're going to expect. But it's a very tailored to be fun experience. It's not just emptiness. And that's the big key, is making sure that it's unpredictable, but interesting. Not just, you could have something to be random and be really, really boring, which isn't what we're going for.
And from an engineering standpoint, how do you keep that from feeling like just you're zoning into an instance with some procedural generation? And anyone can answer this who's maybe closest to the bone on this, but as a player, you want to feel like this is a first time for you, right? You go in and you've got a goal, and that goal involves doing a bunch of stuff, but it's fresh every time. That on paper, that's always sounded so good. But then in practice, sometimes it's a little too random, or it's not curated enough, or it breaks a lot or whatever. So whoever wants to speak to this, I want to explore that further. How are you going to make that stuff feel fresh when you, you know, when you get in there, whether that's from an engineering standpoint or a creative standpoint?
Yeah, I can talk about that a little bit. I think that a lot of games, and this isn't really a criticism of those games, because some of these are games I love, actually, but I think a lot of games start with, we're going to make like a landscape, we'll put a bunch of trees and rocks and stuff on it, and then we'll try and find some spot where you might have fun. And, you know, there are some things to like about that. It does mean that you can make very beautiful looking worlds. You can do things like rivers and erosion and all of that stuff. And so I think a lot of games, like you said, which are kind of really lean into procedural generation can look good, but they just feel kind of really dry and kind of lifeless, like soulless perhaps. And so we're actually approaching it from a different way, which is we're trying to kind of codify the design elements of what you do in building a level. And that isn't like when you design a level in a traditional game, you don't start with where are the trees going to be. Like you start with what are the cool things that are going to happen? Where are the objectives? Where are the like points of interest? Where are the, what is the journey that the player goes through in the level? And then we build backwards from that. And so it isn't about placing a bunch of rocks and trees. It's about building this kind of player journey through the blue zone. And so, and that's the major kind of objective of the zone, but also the side content. And then given that, then you build an environment that kind of supports that goal. So, you know, we haven't finished it yet, and so we don't know. But the work we've done are kind of promising that this will make the zone feel a lot more intentful, a lot more purposeful than, you, like I said, like trying to backfit that into a terrain that wasn't built with that in the mind.
Well, to Cam's point, James, what do you do? See, this is another problem I have with when people talk about a more random experience. Random is maybe not the right word, but a more unique experience every time you enter a space. Are attempts being made on the back end, and maybe they're already there, I don't know, but ways of making that feel less like there's always a door and a load screen before this can happen? In other words, how will I transition from one to the other? If that's even a thing we can talk about yet, I don't know.
Sure. So our goal really is to have a cohesive world where you don't see a loading screen and you don't see your friends disappear when you're running around. Right. And I can actually talk about one of the directions we're taking is we want to minimize phasing that a lot of MMOs have in sharding. We'll still need to do some back-end work, but we really want to eliminate or minimize how often you see your friends disappear, because can really just ruin the experience for you if you're playing with your friends, or even you meet someone, a stranger, and you're running along doing stuff together. Maybe you didn't join their group or become their friend, and you run across an invisible boundary and they just poof, right? So we're trying really hard to avoid that. But there are some natural breakpoints where it actually is okay. Like, so for example, the blue zones are generated for you based kind of on your choices, and they're generated on the fly. So what that means is it's kind of reasonable to hit a loading screen to load onto the new map, which we just generated out of thin air. I think that's not too much of a lift for players. And then it's also a custom zone built for you and maybe for your friends. So you're explicitly crossing this boundary. I also think it might be okay when you're entering a city. You're saying we're going from like this, the red zone where there are, you know, a bunch of people killing monsters. And now we're entering a city where there are thousands of people. Of course, there might be a transition right out of the gate. But when you're playing moment-to-moment combat, that's when we really don't want to phase and we really don't want a loading screen.
Interesting. When I play a game like, I don't know, Uncharted or something, people always make fun of this load-hiding technique, which is Nathan Drake or some character squeezing through a tight space. And then behind that is loading or whatever. I actually think that's kind of genius. I mean, now that we know what the wizard's doing behind the curtain, maybe it's funny and we can all see it and notice it when it happens. But I really like that kind of stuff. Greg, are you pushing from a design standpoint for more of that sort of, they don't really know what we're doing back here? And to the player, it just seems like, well, of course I have to go through this crevasse because I got to get to the other side sort of thing.
Yeah, when we say loading screen, it doesn't literally have to be a bar that fills up, and we probably won't do that. But the fiction of this world is that you're traveling to all of these different places, so that gives us time to load in the graphics. And honestly, we don't know what it looks like yet. Maybe it's you get on an airship, and while the airship's traveling, you know, we do an Indiana Jones red line, and then we fill it all in. or maybe you're flying through space, or you step through a portal or something like that. But and we're not, it's not going to take like 2 minutes, I hope, to generate a blue zone, but it'll take a few seconds. And so we need to distract you a little bit while that's happening behind the scenes.
Yeah, and you don't want other players wandering in there either. That's the other thing, right? You want you and the people you're going in there with, if whether you're solo or running with friends or whatever, it would be chaos if everybody could get to your random, quote unquote, random generated blue zone.
Yeah, that's the whole point, is the blue zone kind of belongs to you and your friends, because we also have the more standard MMO zones where you'll see lots of people running around. So we're hoping that most players enjoy both, and kind of whatever you're in the mood for at the time of, I want the epic experience and to see a lot of people around, go hang out in a red zone. But when you want to kind of do your own thing and have more of an impact on the world and see something new, you pick a blue zone.
Cam, I hopefully this is a question that makes sense. If you are trying to build this out, you're using Unreal, you've got your ideas, you're in the early stages, obviously, where things are at right now. More now than ever, this technology is changing at such a rapid pace. Things like cloud computing and the way server centers work more as not just storage places or access points, but actually a big part of the computing experience. AI and how different implementations of that rear its head in gaming, this sort of stuff. It's changing so fast. I guess this is another advantage of going with Unreal, because Unreal is just probably going to always be around and will always be sort of, adapting to that environment. But are you worried about that at all? You know, like World of Warcraft started with literally a shard or server blade for an entire server. That's all different now. It's all virtualized and different. Are you concerned, or are you planning ahead for that kind of rapid change in the business?
Yeah, Greg has one of those server blades right behind him.
Blackhand. So, there it is. That's awesome. There it is.
Well, so I guess short answer, we're definitely planning ahead. And like you said, using Unreal actually helps us with that a lot. We don't need an army of engineers to keep up with the latest and greatest on anything that Unreal is building for us, because Epic is doing that for us. So thank you, Epic. Much appreciated. Our intent is for this game, assuming, people like it, it'll be around for a long time. And so we really need to plan for, this isn't the type of game where you lock everything down, you're like, that's the final version of everything, we're burning it onto a disc and we'll put it on shelves for Thanksgiving. I mean, those days are gone. That is not how MMOs work, and that's not how we're building our game. We're definitely building it so that each element can be upgraded, and we expect and are planning to upgrade every single element over time. Like, I think I terrify people when I say this, but the things we're building now, in 10 years' time, none of these things will exist. We will have rewritten everything all the time, because, like you said, we want to keep up to date with latest technology.
So that's interesting, because like things like the Source engine over at Valve is essentially, the great great grandson of what the Quake 2 engine, I think, is where they started with Half-Life 1. But it's so completely rewritten. I mean, is it conceivable at some point that you guys have the FPC engine that started as Unreal, but you've written so much over it that it's now yours, and both legally and practically, it's essentially your own custom engine?
Certainly we'll have what we'll call, the ghost editor, the ghost engine, right? But I can't really speak to whether we can license that out. but like Cam says, we have to be kind of smart about how we allocate our resources for building systems, because lots of stuff will get deprecated over time. And one of the things I learned on Fortnite is sometimes you have to go slow to go fast. And Fortnite, it always keeps up to date on the latest engine release. They're, maybe a couple months behind. So they embrace the new technology and kind of keep the house tidy by fighting tech debt along the way. And that's one of the approaches that we're taking as well. So that's when both me and Cam were talking about, like, we might not have the same systems today that we will when we ship, because we want to be able to support a live service for, say, 10 years after we ship. We have to have kind of a light touch and be smart about the where we spend the time developing systems. But we're already investigating. We're on top of kind of the latest trends. We work with our partners at NetEase. There's a cool tool that Ken might want to talk about for how we're kind of authoring blue zone terrain and foliage. And it goes back to your question about, like, well, is how do you make it interesting, right? And I think the answer is it's a mesh of procedural content generation using machine learning and designers and artists working together. So one cool is that we have a way you can paint in the terrain where you want mountains to appear and where you want trees to appear and stuff like that. And then we use a machine learning model to kind of fill in the tedious work to make what the designer wanted to make. And then we can make lots of variations of that very quickly. So we can do it in seconds rather than, you know, the time it would take the designer to do it. So we can make a lot more content with that, but it's still being driven by designers and artists who are making the actual stuff that goes into the game, like the trees and everything.
We do get a lot of questions about AI and Ghost. Well, we get this for my various shows. We get this for everything in the gaming business. Everybody's worried that robots are going to do everything and that creatives are not going to do it. But taking all that hyperbole out of the equation for a second, it sounds like you guys have some real rubber meets the road plans for machine learning, maybe large language models, that kind of stuff. Do you want to
investigating it right now? Like, we're in prototype, so everything's still on the table. We have a bunch of ideas and we're listening to, we need feedback from the players to figure out what they really like. So it might be the answer to use machine learning because it can generate the blue zones very quickly, but maybe they're not as, you know, soulful as we want or something. So maybe we bring it back and do more rules-based stuff. We'll always have kind of rules layering on top of this to insert like the gameplay elements, like the POIs. So you fight a dragon here and then you go up to the castle up there. Designer's always going to kind of design those, but through a rules-based system where it can kind of change and then layer on lots of rules together to make an interesting experience each time.
Does any of that have you guys excited or about the possibilities anyway or something with behavior of NPCs? More dynamic, maybe more realistic behavior from NPCs as a result of either machine learning or AI models or that sort of thing. Like where, James, where are we with that? And do you guys feel like that is going to benefit your design, your MMO?
I think we're still in the early stages. There's definitely some machine learning models that are actually built into Unreal now, and they're using them for things like cloth simulation, actually. So rather than doing the physics simulation of cloth on your character, they can just use an AI model to say, where should my shirt fall? And it's much faster and more efficient. Mm. But we're in the early stages. Cam might have something to add to that.
Yeah, I think one thing we definitely want to do is we want to have like a lot of interesting like interactivity and behaviors in our environments. I think one of the things that will make these environments interesting is you'll have a lot of creatures doing a lot of interesting things, and all the, you know, from squirrels all the way up to dragons, and not just in size and kind of complexity of behavior. And so some of that I think is a good match for learning, for machine learning. I think some of it is a good match just for like, if you apply rules but just to a lot of things, that makes it interesting. So we'll almost certainly have a mix of those things, but I think there's definitely room for machine learning in kind of complicated behavior models. But I think most of it will probably still be rules driven, because I think we still want the control to be in the hands of designers as opposed to in the hands of an ML model.
Sure. You have some fun bloopers to play with, but I get the idea of wanting to, you know, put feet on the ground a little bit.
I could give an example.
Please do.
Of how it might work. In a blue zone, we, the developers, don't know like where the roads will be or where the villagers might be. So when we spawn bandits, the bandits have to have kind of a notion of, I'm a bandit, I should like find a road and lay an ambush, because that's what a bandit means. You know, in a game like World of Warcraft, someone is hand placing where all those bandits are going to spawn. They can kind of decide, oh, this is where the Defias Brotherhood is going to be. But for us, a lot of that is randomly generated on the fly. So we just, bandits kind of have to have a notion of, this is what being a bandit means to me. Mm. Likewise, a dragon, you know, might look for things to eat or for gold to accumulate. I don't want to make it sound like we're making a simulation game, but we do need to make sure that like all the enemies behave in ways that make sense, even though we don't know what the terrain looks like.
So the idea is that you want the player to feel like the world is kind of playing itself in a way and not just reacting to you. I could appreciate that as a player, because there are times where, I don't know, we'll use WoW as an example. If I'm walking around in the Barrens and I see some, I don't know, some NPCs wandering around, I know that they are always going to be right there. And if I kill them right now and there's hardly anyone else around, the respawn's going to be longer. And if there are more people here, it'll be quicker because the system is designed to not make people wait too long. for, you know, their chance at the content. So there's certain rules that just become really obvious to a player, and it's fine. We live with it. We play the game and it's okay. We don't, you know, we're not complaining or anything, but it would be cool if it felt like that world was kind of going on without me. And like you said, not like just a simulation to see what happens. This isn't a God game where I, you know, throw down some wheat and watch people fight over it. This isn't Black and White or one of those kind of games, but knowing that if an NPC, you know, I don't know, a gnoll gets too close to this dragon, that dragon might just lean over and eat it. That's interesting to me from a player standpoint, because then the world feels a little more wild and untamed, and perhaps, you know, the danger is even more real, even though maybe it's not that dangerous given my level or my gear or whatever, but still that feeling of like, you never know what could happen out here within reason, because if you go too far with that, you know, you can't have trees suddenly becoming sentient and walking around and, you know, kicking bunnies across the field or whatever. There seems like there's a real balance there. And from a designer standpoint, from your perspective, Greg, like what is there a line for you where you're just like, well, we don't want the world to think too much on its own, you know?
That's absolutely right. Yeah. A lot of the games that say, hey, we're going to have infinite worlds and you're never going to see the same things twice. I'm thinking about games like No Man's Sky or even Starfield or even Diablo, when you think about it with its randomly generated dungeons. What they're going for is infinite variety, which is great. Like, I'm not disparaging any of those games. That's their goal. We're thinking something that's more like when you play a game of Civilization or Age of Empires, for that matter, the random map is different every time. It's not necessarily radically different. You're not suddenly going to like find a new biome that doesn't exist on Earth. It's going to look like Earth, but just the variation of there's water over here this time, or there's a silver mine close by, really changes up your opening moves. And so we hope that's what the Blue Zone experience is like. Not that, oh my God, anything can happen. And on this map, all of the trees are sentient and come to life and attack me. But it's more of when I play on a desert map, I expect these certain things to happen, but I don't know ahead of time where the dragon's going to live or where the treasure chest is, because that is variable.
Right. Interesting. Critical in the chat asked a question I think is interesting. And this would, I think, go to Greg, given your old school status among us here. Does the genius of old games that came out of the limitations of the technology still exist? Is that still and also, of course, Cam and James, feel free to pipe in on this. But Greg, as someone who worked, you know, on Age of Empires 2 in particular, a lot of the genius would come out of your limitations, and now you kind of don't have any. Is that good or bad? Like, I don't even know how I would take that if I was making video games.
There's always limitations. They're just different ones now than they used to be. With Age of Empires, we struggled a lot with how big can the population cap be? And our like default one, I think, was 75 units, but players would always bump it up to 250 or something like that.
Yeah.
We still, believe me, we're still gonna have limitations. Like, we hope to be on console. You can't go slap more RAM in those consoles. They come with what they come with. So you have to design around that. You have to make sure you can patch the game and stream the audio or whatever else. You have, you know, engineers are always fond of saying the speed of light is a constant. That part doesn't get faster as technology improves. So we still have ping and we still have to worry about client server times.
Yeah. There's a question in the chat about that very thing that I would throw to, I'll ask this one of Cam and then James, of course, who can answer this as well. But it says, I've got a question. This is from DeathMist18. I have a question I'd love to know more deeply about. When it comes to large scale combat, how might you try to minimize lag and desync from the server/client? Something players worry about regardless of their bandwidth. What would you say to that, Cam?
Yeah, we did deal with this a bunch on a previous game I've worked on, Guild Wars 2, where we had fairly large scale battles. I think the most important one is LOD, level of detail. And so I guess there's kind of two aspects to it. There's like the visual frame rate, and then there is like the networking. And both of those benefit from LOD and from a kind of an important system. You want to make sure that the things that are important to you are the things that are behaving really fluidly. And so that might be something you're finding. It might be the people on your team. It might be the thing you're currently looking at. And so there's a bunch of kind of systems we'll use for like LOD-ing in the things that are important to you to make sure that those things have have better latency. We can also do a bunch of client-side prediction. Exactly what that looks like, I don't know, because there's kind of some feeding aspects to that as well, some integrity aspects to that. But we can also simulate a bunch of things on the client and then only kind of do fix-ups with the server when the server and the client disagree, which doesn't have to happen in an obvious way and doesn't have to happen that often. So I guess the short answer is it's very early, but this is an important thing for us. Greg's talked about the kind of scale that we're going to try and look at. And I think that, especially with modern internet, modern computers, and kind of modern approach to kind of network topology, we can have a pretty smooth experience of the kind of scale we're talking about.
James, anything you'd add to that?
Yeah, Cam kind of hit all the points. But WoW was designed for a half a second latency, right? Because internet connections weren't great back in 2004. Nowadays, internet connections are a bit better. So we, it's just kind of easier in that regard. But at the same time, Cam was talking about prediction in the client. So Unreal has one of the benefits is it has a lot of prediction built in. So the gameplay ability system we're using to make gameplay effects like casting fireballs and health regeneration is predicted on the client, meaning the client will run the same simulation as the server, and it will assume, well, next it's been 2 seconds, so my health is supposed to tick up. So I'll just show the UI ticking up. And if I made a mistake and there was some desync or whatever, I can reset it and we can deal with that. But in most cases, the vast majority of cases, there is no desync. Something like your health ticking, the client knows it's about to go back up. Nothing else is really going to interrupt it. And the same thing with movement, right? You get pretty smooth movement because of prediction. If we didn't have prediction and we synchronized your movement over the network, you'd see everyone stuttering all the time because you're always kind of slightly out of sync with the server.
Yeah, we were having some community Unreal Tournament 2K4 games recently, and boy, I forgot how that can happen. Like, what would happen is the players are actually doing okay. Predictive stuff for your fellow players on your team were okay, and also who you were shooting were okay. But if they got into one of these big turrets in an assault map, that thing became like a stop motion puppet, and it was weird. Like, for a minute I was like, I don't remember it being like this, but that's kind of how it all used to be. And it's good that we're getting this far. I would follow up with this question. I've been following Unreal's development, and I'm super interested in how it's being used in film. And the Oscars gave best short animated film to a film made entirely in Unreal, which I thought was really interesting, kind of a first of its kind. And one of the things I've been touting in 5.2 was, speaking of LOD or level of detail, they were talking about the new technology involving, and forgive me if I get any of this wrong, but it's something to do with what they call their nanite technology. Essentially, it meant that instead of a far off tree starting out as a two-dimensional flat single textured polygon, now they didn't have to do that. They could have a interpolated, very nice looking tree that was just very far away, and your eyes would see it as what it was. And the closer you got, it never popped again into a four-sided polygon, and then popped again into a fully realized polygon, which really can take you out of certain games. I think MMOs, right. I think we're forgiving in MMOs of that sort of thing, but are we going to see that sort of stuff in this engine, or does that present a bunch of problems for MMO gameplay or, MMO structure?
Yeah, so I can talk about this a bit, if you don't mind, Cam. So we're on 5.3, so we're going to investigate nanite, also Lumen, the lighting model. And the real benefit of nanite is the production pipeline. So artists typically sculpt the model or the tree or whatever they're making, super high resolution, talking millions of polygons, right? And then they decimate it or they turn it into a game-ready model by cleaning up the topology and reducing the number of triangles, right? So that the game can actually handle it. And usually then there'll be an LOD process where they'll take, okay, this is the close-up model, and then they'll reduce it further and further at distances, and you can even replace it with a card, an imposter far away, and there's some really nice tech in Unreal to do all of that. But what Nanite does is it does it automatically for you using kind of clusters. Basically, you give it almost infinite geometry, and it generates the LODs for you of almost like pixels, right? So the thing you're looking at is always the right resolution for the number of pixels it's mapping to on the screen. So really, it cuts out the time spent by the artist plugging in the LOD parameters and doing the computation to make the different models, because usually in Unreal you have like, say, three LODs, and as you get further away, it blends between them, right? So this lets you start with millions of triangles and not have to pare them down. It does it automatically for you based on the exact resolution it really needs.
It's super fascinating to watch, because I can tell this massive difference between what used to be kind of crummy looking faraway stuff. And I wonder from like, when you hear this sort of stuff, Greg, as designer or sort of lead of this game, do these things change your plan? In other words, how do I put this? Like, that kind of fidelity sounds amazing. Like, I so look forward to playing this and really any game that employs this kind of stuff, because it really truly does feel like a kind of a next generation leap in quality. But for you to be able to say, well, I really need this compelling ogre fight to matter. Do those things really matter? Like, you know, like, to you, is this more about you saying, well, I need this ogre fight to matter, and so writers, sound guys, artists, let's go. Hey, back end, make it as pretty as you can, and then just you'll be surprised at how beautiful this is. Like, I'm just really curious about that relationship.
Particularly for a live service game, and particularly for an MMO, you hope that it kind of stands the test of time. So chasing photorealism is hard because photorealism evolves so quickly. I think one of the reasons World of Warcraft has endured is because they picked kind of a timeless style, and we're not going to pick the same art style for our game, but when you chase photorealism, a few years later, it doesn't look cutting edge anymore. So I tend to think more about what's the gameplay experience we want, and we know we need a lot of content, so anything we can do to, you know, I'd rather have an artist make three different trees than spend a lot of time making one tree able to like scale through LOD or not. So that's just like time savings. The human part of making the game can be just like make a beautiful scene and not worry about how to solve all the, you know, the issues when frame rate drops or you have a weaker graphics card or those kind of things.
Sure. We get a text here from Mike who asks this. Cam, we'll throw this one to you. What kind of access are you going to be able to grant people to visit your blue shards? If you're setting up something like a house or a guild shard or something, will there be an easy way to share that with people to visit? I'll even go further and say, let's say you're halfway done with the encounter. You're halfway done with your blue shard and your friend pops online. Oh, hey, I didn't know you were started. Well, come on in. Is that a thing A, you feel technically confident about, and B, is that even a part of what you want to do?
Yeah, I'll talk about the tech side, and then Greg, you can talk about the design side. I mean, from the tech side, we're making an MMO, and so all of the tech that we have available for MMO style features, like obviously like our multiplayer, that will apply everywhere in the game. And then it's really just like, what is the right thing from a design perspective? The tech will enable any design that we like. And so if we want people to be able to invite their friends, their guilds, everybody, just themselves to blue zones, that's all technically capable. That the engine is kind of technically capable of that. But then, Greg, maybe you want to talk about, like, what is the design intent for what the blue zones are all about?
Sure.
Yeah, from a design side, that's exactly what we want, is you decide kind of, you have a club and you get to decide who's a member of your club. And you can decide, oh, I'm going to have this random person off the street. That's because I'm comfortable with taking that risk. Or you can say, oh, no, it's just for me and my friends. One of the biggest challenges we want to undertake is to make that really, really seamless. I know we've all had the experience when you want to play multiplayer with a friend and you get into a game and then the beginning is like, okay, we got to make our own server and make sure we're friends on Steam. And then I got to send you the password. And then we got to make sure we're on the same shard. And ideally it would just be, I log in, I see that Scott's doing something. I'm like, hey, Scott, can I join you? You're like, yeah, let me throw you an invite. And now we're together. And I could be like, oh, I really like this castle you made in your blue zone. This is super cool. Like, that should be the feeling, so that you're focused on the game, not on kind of playing the menu.
That's a really good point. I do not like the metagame of menu play. Not a huge fan of that. It really takes you out of the world if that happens.
And it's hard. I mean, I get it, because you're solving a ton of really difficult problems, both design and technology of, where are we? How do we get together? How do I make sure random people don't come in? How do we find each other? I mean, but at the end of the day, like you said, players don't care about that. They just kind of want it to work. So we have to be super smart and predict all of that ahead of time.
James, I have a question about, like, the Unreal Engine, I know we keep kind of going back to this engine, like the engine's all that matters. But since this is such a big part of our discussion today, is this going to make it easier for multi-platform plans than it would otherwise? In other words, if you had to build your own engine, I assume there would be certain obstacles that don't exist because you're using such an industry standard, already kind of plugged into everybody sort of engine. Is that a fair assumption?
Absolutely. Unreal supports basically all platforms out of the box. There's always a little bit of work, right? So the sooner we get the automation running where it builds on those platforms to shake out bugs, the better. So and even in recent years, not that we would necessarily target mobile, but UE5 is actually really good on mobile now. And I think there's a perception that Unity's really good at mobile and Unreal 5 isn't. It's too heavyweight. And I don't think that's really true anymore. We shipped for a long time Fortnite on Android and iOS. And I think it's going back to iOS now in Europe. Yeah. But on Android for a long time. And that was very challenging, but it runs a kind of a simpler version of the game. So things like, you asked earlier about Nanite, but also Lumen, that won't run on those platforms because they really can't support.
Right.
So it's about making the choice for what is best for our games. So if we want Nanite, we want those beautiful vistas with a ton of objects in the scene, then we will get automatic support for the next generation consoles like PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X. But it may not make sense for all the extra work we have to do, and it would look visually different on other platforms. But we do get it out of the box, and I've already done some back-end work to run it on a different platform already, so it's pretty straightforward.
Mm, that's super interesting stuff to me. I hope people get a good technical vibe out of what we're talking about today, and I know there are going to be some follow-up questions from people. We'll make sure to pass those on, answer them on future episodes. And that sort of thing. I do want to start doing a thing that I haven't done up to this point, and that is go around and talk about everybody. Just real quick, tell me what your favorite video game ever is. All right, we'll see if this sticks or not. Cam, we'll start with you. My experience with these with big dev teams is you're all gamers. You come to it with a love for the medium. Elsewise, why would you even be interested in the business? So what is your game of a lifetime? At least until Ghost launches. What is it?
Yeah, well, I guess, okay, so my game of a lifetime is definitely Ocarina of Time. I think that is, like, one of the most important games ever made. It was just a miraculous game when it came out. I have such incredible memories of playing through that game. It is not the best game ever made now. There are now better games, and in fact, I think Tears of the Kingdom is a better game, and that's kind of, that's also a Zelda game. But, like, in terms of, like, the game which I think has made the most impact to me in my personal gaming experience to the industry, and which still like resonates all throughout every game ever made, I think Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, that thing really opened it up. I have to agree with you there. James, your favorite of all time?
Yeah, I'm not that creative. It's World of Warcraft Classic for me. I just love the old WoW style. I'm really hoping we can bring some of the learnings of, bringing that game back in 2019. What really, like, built the social community, what players really liked about that. I'm really hoping we can bring some of that to Ghost, even while balancing it with, sharding and supporting lots and lots of players and all the next gen combat and everything we want to do. But it was, World of Warcraft has always been my, guiding star for a game. I just love it.
It's funny, we get a lot of people saying, literally the phrase, I hope Ghost is learning from what Classic is doing. And they never get specific. Like, what do they mean? Well, is it the new stuff in phase two, or is it, what is it exactly? And I think you just nailed it. It's this sense of community. Even though we're talking about a game in its older state, you're talking about bringing back a kind of interactivity and social aspect that really hasn't felt like it's been a priority in that game for a long time. And
there's a lot of other pieces there too. Dead space is really important in that game. And, and you're not always on the main quest, like following some simple storyline. We talk a lot about this in our meetings when we're kind of brainstorming here, that it's okay to have downtime in the game and to have dead space where you have to travel. That makes, the valleys make the peaks more memorable.
Right.
So learning all that and adapting it to the modern, tastes of gamers, it's going to look a little different, but I think there's a lot we can pull that we haven't used in a long time.
You heard it here first. Dead Space will be inside of this game. Oh, wait, not that Dead Space. Very different Dead Space. Greg, we've never asked you this question. So pins and needles here. Your most influential favorite game of all time.
I mean, I have way too many, and if I come here every month, I'll have a different answer, but... One of my favorite games of all time is the XCOM series. Even the original ones, the more recent updates. At Blizzard, we talk a lot about like what is the fantasy that you're trying to create for players. And XCOM does an amazing fantasy of I'm this total badass recon SEAL Team 6 tactical person. Even if you know nothing more than like what you've seen on TV of like, well, hide behind the door, duck behind cover, but you feel like such a badass, you know, picking off aliens that way.
Yeah.
And I think XCOM just is continues to delight me every time I play it.
I do love XCOM. Well, Cam stole mine, so I would have said Ocarina of Time.
Oh, okay.
You know what? I'll say Mario 64 because I also feel like that changed. In fact, even paved some of the way for Zelda to even work. So, you know, not Nintendo's most successful console, but gosh dang it, there were some influential games on that thing. Well, that's going to do it for us this week, everybody. Thank you all for watching. Big thanks to Cam and James. Thank you guys for being here so much. It was awesome having you on.
Thank you.
Greg, as usual, always a blast to hang with you, dude. I'm glad things are going well. Are you feeling good? Are you, ahead of everything? Are you just like stoked? Are you jazzed all the time or what?
I get a little nervous because it's kind of going too well. Like the team is happy. We're making a lot of progress. We hire great people all the time. And I'm like, you know, part of me is like, what am I missing? You know, when's the other shoe going to drop? But making games is hard. So as long as it's smooth sailing, I'll be happy.
All right, good. Well, I can't wait to meet up again in One Earth Month where we can talk about more about the development of Ghost, and things are coming along nicely. Everybody keeps saying, when are we going to see some alpha footage? When are we going to see all this stuff? Don't worry, you guys. It's coming. It'll be here.
It's coming.
It's all coming. I'm sure they've seen some amazing stuff, you know, on the ground. We'll get to see it soon enough. Stay tuned to the show. And here's how you do it. Go to frogpants.com/street for the podcast. You can find links to that everywhere. You can also find it linked at fantasticpixelcastle.com, which will be the home of all things Project Ghost. So if you're trying to keep up, that's where it'll be. And we hope to see you next time. Thanks for your questions, your comments. Send us more, 801-471-0462 for your texts and voicemails. Happy to play those on the show as well. Until next time, we'll see you then.
Get more at frogpants.com.